Maybe we'll get started. We're delighted to have with us today Stefan Talman, who's a university lecturer in public international law at Oxford, also a fellow at St. Anne's College and an adjunct member of our faculty here at Moritz. And I want to mention right now that Dr. Talman is the first of three distinguished Oxford Law faculty members who will be visiting this academic year in a program that's co-sponsored by the College of Law and the Mershon Center. The two others, Ann Davis and Nick Bamforth, will be coming in late March and in mid-April. All three will speak on international or comparative law subjects, delivering two different talks, one here at the law school and one at the Mershon Center. Participating in some classes here at Moritz, Stefan has already been in a seminar this morning. We're trying to work him very hard. Meeting with groups of law students and undergraduates as well as interested law faculty. And I was impressed that although he arrived and was jet-lagged last night, he managed to figure out sometime between when we had finished dinner and this morning that he, in addition to the laptop that's provided at the flat that he's in, the apartment at the Gateway Center, which we didn't have a login number for, that his own laptop could hook up, if he moved around in the apartment, to the Barnes & Noble wireless network. I'm not sure I should be saying that in front of our IP faculty, but at least as a temporary measure, it was useful. Dr. Talman was born in Germany. He studied law at universities of Tübingen and Munich. He went on to secure an LLM at Cambridge and a DPhil at Oxford. In addition to his Oxford positions now, he's an associate professor at the University of Tübingen. He's held visiting professorships at universities in France, Turkey, and the Ukraine. And in his capacity as a member of our faculty, he supervises student research projects in international law and international affairs as part of our law school semester program at Oxford. In his spare time, he's authored or edited at least seven books and over 30 articles. He's a practicing German barrister, and he has represented and advised governments and corporations on matters of international and European law. He will speak for 20 to 25 minutes, and I've told him of our status as a collegial group of probing questioners, and he looks forward to your responses and feedback. If you raise your hand or your eyebrow or nod or wink at me or do something as questioning opens, I'll take down names and try to maintain some semblance of order. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you for having me. I want to speak about the legislative remodeling of societies and take the U.S. occupation law in Iraq as a starting point. On the 4th of June 2003, Alan Larson, U.S. Undersecretary for Economic, Business, and Agricultural Affairs, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the future of Iraq. And that's what he had to say. We speak about the reconstruction of Iraq, but the word is misleading. We are looking not at reconstruction, but at construction. Not at rebuilding, but at building. The Iraqi people must overcome the damage of 25 years of corrupt and vicious tyranny to build their society into a lively and historic center in the Middle East. Statements such as this have raised eyebrows in Europe over the US intentions. And European academic debate with regard to the occupation law or the laws adopted by the occupying power in Iraq is highly critical. In the American literature, on the other hand, we find a new term, transformative occupation. Transformative occupation distinguishing this kind of occupation from the normal occupation we have seen so far in international law, and it should give the occupier more powers. In the European debate, the problems arise from the intentions behind the war. As early as 1998, the U.S. passed a Iraq Liberation Act, in which it said that the intention is to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power and to establish a new system of government in Iraq. What I want to do in the time available is to look at some of the legislative acts of the occupying powers from April 2003 to June 2004. As you all remember, the ground war started on the 20th of March. Baghdad was occupied on the 9th of April. And on the 10th of April, President Bush announced in a message to the Iraqi people that the regime of Saddam Hussein is being removed from power. So regime change was the purpose of the exercise. On the 16th of April, the commander of coalition forces created what became known as the Coalition Provisional Authority. And on the 6th of May, Ambassador Bremner was appointed administrator of Iraq. In this capacity, he promulgated a regulation on the 16th of May, Regulation Number 1, which vested the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, with all legislative, executive, and judicial authority to achieve its objectives, whatever these objectives were. On the same day, the first order of the CPA was published on the de-Ba'athification of Iraqi society. In June, the Coalition Provisional Authority started to publish Al-Waqai al-Iraqia, where you have a copy of in front of you of some of the front pages. In the first issue, Bremner wrote, "Under my direction, the CPA has undertaken to suspend the unjust and oppressive laws imposed by the former regime and to publish these new legal instruments as a means of establishing a fair and just judicial system for the Iraqi people." In the next 14 months, 9 issues of Al-Waqai al-Iraqia were published with numerous laws. In all, there were 12 regulations, 99 orders, 15 memoranda, and 12 public notices, all containing laws applicable in Iraq. In all, these were several thousand pages. On the 25th of June 2004, shortly before the hand hour of power, Bremner presented the new Prime Minister of Iraq with bound volumes of all these new Iraqi laws in Arabic and dozens of additional proposals for future laws to be adopted by the interim government. These laws span a wide variety of subject areas. First of all, of course, political reform. The Ba'ath Party was prohibited. The governmental system was purged of former party members. The Coalition Provisional Authority created a whole new structure of government, a democratic structure of government. It adopted, for this reason, electoral laws, a law for political parties and entities. It established an independent electoral commission. And, above all, it had the Iraqi Governing Council adopt a transitional administrative law for Iraq. I mentioned this law, although it was adopted not by the Coalition Provisional Authority itself, but by the Iraqi government for one reason. Under international law, the occupier cannot just set up any kind of domestic structure and thereby absolve itself from its legal obligations. Any such entity like the Iraqi Governing Council that was established during the occupation will automatically be seen as a subordinate body, or in other terms, a puppet of the occupier. And all the acts
of that entity will be automatically attributed under international law to the occupier itself. So the new governmental structure that was adopted on the 8th of March 2003 by the Iraqi Governmental Council is basically the governmental structure adopted by the occupier. The Iraqi Governing Council just acted as the mouthpiece here. This transitional administrative law established a republican, federal, democratic, and pluralistic society, markedly different from the system in place when the occupation started. But there was not just political reform, there was also institutional restructuring. Over the 14 months of the occupation, the CPA created some 24 new commissions, bodies, which oversaw a whole range of Iraqi public life. For example, a National Communications and Media Commission was established by the occupying power, but also a Central Criminal Court. What probably raised the most eyebrows was the economic restructuring of Iraq by the occupying power. There were laws on foreign investment, a new banking system was introduced, a new tax system was introduced, a new currency, a new company law, and a new patent law. All things you normally don't associate with an occupier. What does an occupier care about patents? But of course, in Europe, the idea was, of course, the occupier models a society in its own image, thereby gaining competitive advantages for its own business in the country. If you are operating in the same legal framework abroad as at home, you have an advantage over your competitors. I just take one such law as an example. Order 39 of the 19th of September concerned foreign investment. Foreign investment in Iraq was not possible prior to the occupation for residents or for non-residents of Arab countries. There was no possibility of foreign ownership of countries. This was all radically changed. Now we had 100% foreign ownership of all companies, unrestricted tax-free transfer of all profits abroad. Real property could be leased for up to 40 years by foreigners. And there was general equal treatment of foreigners and Iraqis with regard to any investment matter. If we look at all these measures from a traditional point of view of international law, the conclusion is easy. It's all basically illegal. Under the traditional law of occupation, the occupier has a very limited power to alter the legal system of the occupied country. What rules is the so-called conservationist principle. The occupier is the guardian of the de jure sovereign that is temporarily unable to govern its own country. The laws on occupation are laid down in the Hague Regulations on Land Warfare of 1907 and the Geneva Convention of 1949. There is also an additional protocol to the Geneva Convention of 1977, but the United States and the United Kingdom as occupying powers have not signed up to that protocol, and therefore I'll leave it out of the picture at the moment. One other source of law for the occupant is human rights law, although this again is disputed by the United States, who takes the view that international humanitarian law replaces human rights law in times of occupation. This has just been refuted convincingly by the International Court of Justice in the Palestinian wall case, where the International Court of Justice ruled that both international humanitarian law and human rights law are applicable to occupied territory. The conventional view is that The occupier takes the law as he finds it at the time of occupation, and he preserves that legal system for the time of occupation. The only thing the occupier may do is basically alter the law insofar as his own security is concerned. So the occupier may introduce an amendment to the criminal law criminalizing attacks on the occupying power or on its line of communications. But it definitely may not undertake such a fundamental restructuring of a society as we have seen in Iraq. This view also was taken, or seemed to have been taken, by one of the occupiers, the United Kingdom. The Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, in a leaked memo for Tony Blair, wrote in March 2003 that the imposition of major structural reforms would not be authorized under international law unless the Security Council specifically authorizes it. Now, is that the end of the matter? Some of my colleagues, especially American colleagues, have tried to come up with alternative sources of authority. First of all, it was claimed that the consent of the Iraqi authority made it all possible, referring to the acquiescence of the Iraqi Governing Council. But of course, that's very difficult to maintain. First of all, the lawmaking started in May 2003. The Governing Council did not come into effect until September 2003. So how do you cover your first loss? But even if you take the consent of the Iraqi Governing Council as something to go by, it's very difficult to reconcile with, again, general international law. Because as I have pointed out before, an entity, a local administrative body set up by the occupier during occupation, is seen as part of the occupation structure. It's part of the occupier itself. It's a subordinate body. It's just an arm of the occupier. And we have seen that during the Second World War. Germany tried to do that in Norway. It tried to do that in Greece, establishing local governments. And it was not accepted. These governments were always seen as German puppets, and all their acts were attributed to the German occupying power at the time. So probably the predominant view in international law is that the acts of the Iraqi Governing Council must be attributed to the Coalition Provisional Authority and thereby to the occupying powers. And to raise one controversial issue, I'd probably say the same applied to the Iraqi interim government. Although this was a wonderful public relations exercise when Jerry Bremner basically turned over the reins of power to Mr. Alavi on the 28th of June, but I don't think that at that stage in time the occupation of Iraq actually came to an end. Because, again, as you can see from the transitional administrative law that was adopted earlier on and that was governing the operations of this new interim government, this new interim government was still bound by the laws the CPA had put in place. So it was still operating within a legal framework, within a legal straitjacket that had been put up by the Coalition Provisional Authority before it actually left. So probably the occupation came to an end, in my view, at the time when we saw a freely elected Iraqi government, and not before. So I don't think that the consent of the Iraqi authorities is anything to go by. So what is the next alternative? Security Council authorization. This is generally accepted that the Security Council can authorize states, a coalition of the willing, to administer foreign territory, thereby not being bound by the laws of occupation. This is basically laid down in Article 103 of the UN Charter, which provides that binding decisions of the Security Council overrule other treaty commitments of the member states. the laws of occupation would be such a treaty commitment, and the same probably applies to customary international law. There is just one dissenting voice here in the United States, a colleague called Alan Boyle, who basically sees the Security Council constrained in doing such a thing as authorizing an occupying power to divert from the laws of occupation, because he claims the laws of occupation are part of the norms of jus cogens, from which there is no discretion possible. But while he has a point with some norms of international humanitarian law, the human rights aspect of international humanitarian law, the same does not apply to the laws of occupation of everyday administration of a territory, and it does not apply to the lawmaking of the occupier. So we have one resolution which I have printed you on the handout, resolution 1483 of the 22nd of May 2003, which some people claim actually provides the authorization for the occupying powers to remodel Iraqi society. These people normally refer to paragraph 4 of the resolution, which provides that the authority, consistent with the Charter of the UN and other relevant international law, shall promote the welfare of the Iraqi people through the effective administration of the territory. From this task to promote the welfare of the Iraqi people through the effective administration of the territory, people conclude that the occupying powers actually had a carte blanche to restructure Iraq. But of course, first of all, it says consistent with the Charter of the United Nations and other relevant international law, so there is a certain proviso. And of course, we also have paragraph 5 of the resolution, which calls upon all concerned, including the occupying powers, to comply fully with their obligations under international law, in particular the Geneva Convention of 1949 and the Hague Regulation of 1907. And exactly these two instruments so far are seen as the constraints of the occupying power to remodel a society. And if you think about it, what was the context of this resolution? We have seen a deeply divided Security Council, a Security Council that could not agree on the use of force against Iraq. The Europeans were strongly opposed to the American action, at least the French and the German at the time, the Germans at the time on the Security Council. And it's difficult to see how they could, just like 1 month after the beginning of military operation, have just suddenly changed their mind and given the occupying powers a kind of general authorization to do in Iraq whatever they like to do. Similarly, the wording is contradictory at best, ambiguous at best. Whenever we have seen authorizations to administer territory in UN Security Council resolutions, this was done expressly, not in such a kind of ambiguous way. Furthermore, the Security Council only takes note of a letter from the occupying powers informing the Security Council that they had established the Coalition Provisional Authority, but the Security Council itself had not established the Coalition Provisional Authority. It was just taking note of its existence. So it's difficult to reason or to argue that the Security Council wanted to authorize a body which it hadn't set up to remodel Iraqi society. So for that reason, some of my colleagues take recourse to yet another alternative source of authority. They look to international human rights obligations of the occupier. And the argument goes like this. The occupier is bound by its international treaty commitments and customary international law with regard to human rights. Now, if the occupier has obligations under international law, human rights obligations, then he must be able to fulfill these obligations. And for that, the occupier may take legislative actions. And that's perfectly fine, and everybody can agree with that. But the problem is, how do you justify establishing a board of supreme audit, for example, with human rights obligations, or having an inspector general of every Iraqi ministry, or having all these other structural reforms? You would always have to have a human rights issue which triggers these legislative acts, which you didn't have with most of the legislation. Now, so are my colleagues in Europe right that it was all illegal? I want to put to you another source of authority, the old source of authority, namely the laws of occupation. I actually want to go back to the original documents and to the original text. If you go back to Article 43 of the Hague Regulations of 1907, which I've printed on the handout again, the occupier is tasked to take all measures in his power to restore and ensure as far as possible public order and safety while respected, unless absolutely prevented, the laws in force in the country. So if you look just at the text, you could say, oh yes, there is no way for the occupant actually to undertake this legislative remodeling of a society. But of course, we are not just looking at the text. And in this case, the text would be misleading. In 1907, the language of diplomacy was still French, not English. So the original text of this treaty is in French. And we have a small translation error from French into English. So while it says in English, of course, public order and safety, the French text doesn't say anything about safety. The French text speaks about l'ordre et la vie publique. So public order and public life. It's much wider than just safety. So the occupier actually is to ensure as far as public as possible public life in general, the operation of society. Now, of course, you can say it also says the occupier must respect, unless absolutely prevented, the laws in force in the country. That's true. And the French text here is roughly the same. It speaks about empêchement absolu. But what does that mean? In the literature from the early 20th century, it was accepted that absolutely prevented didn't really mean absolutely prevented, because the text was going back to an earlier draft of 1873, the Hague draft of 1873, which spoke of necessity, of necessary. So the absolutely prevented has to be actually read as it may not alter, the occupier may not alter the laws unless it is necessary, not unless he is absolutely prevented. Now, this is somehow supported by a later text, and I've printed that for your convenience as well. That is Article 64, paragraph 2 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949. This is an article that is almost universally overlooked for a very simple reason, because it's in a section that deals only with criminal law. So as one normally deals with lawmaking in general, people think you don't just look at something that deals with criminal law. But Article 64 is divided into two parts. While the first part really deals with criminal law, the second deals with lawmaking in general. And see that also that the article is found in the part of the convention that deals with status and treatment of protected persons in occupied territories. That's not just limited to penal law, but also, of course, includes civil law. Now, here in Article 64, we have three possibilities for the occupier to make laws. And one is to maintain the orderly government of the territory. So the occupier may adopt laws, may change the legal system to maintain the orderly government of the territory. Again, government does not just relate to the structure of government, to the governmental institutions, but must be seen in a wider way as governing the society, governing the country. So I would put forward that if you look at Articles 43 and 64 and interpret them in their historic context, look at the original wording, that we are faced with much wider lawmaking powers of the occupant that is commonly perceived. But of course, the occupant does not have carte blanche. Maintaining the orderly government of the territory is still subject to the requirement of necessity. So whatever the occupant does, it must be necessary. Now, what does it mean, necessary, to enact laws? And here I'd suggest that necessity depends on the context of occupation. If we look at the classic occupation, which we saw in the First and Second World War, where we had an ongoing conflict, where the occupant really was just the temporary administrator of foreign territory, the threshold for necessity is very high, because you never knew whether the enemy, the de jure government of the occupied territory, would not regain the territory in a couple of months' time. So you were just the guardian for that time. Things may be different with regard to prolonged belligerent occupation, as we see, for example, in the Israeli-occupied territories. There, necessity may be determined in a different way. Things may be necessary in the Israeli-Palestinian context that were not necessary in the short-term context of the occupations of the First and Second World War. And I would suggest that there is a third category where necessity has to be interpreted even wider, and that is the situation where a military conflict leads to the total defeat of the enemy, where the occupied territory basically can be compared to a failed state, where governmental structures break down, where one system collapses. In that situation, necessity may be interpreted in a much wider way. Now, this is just basically a short overview over this theory, and I can support this all with a little bit more arguments, but I would like to leave some more questions, time for your questions. I just would like to put forward a kind of reality check for my little theory, that the occupier has much wider lawmaking powers as it is normally perceived in the literature. Think about Germany, 1945 to 49. What the occupying powers did in Germany? They remodeled a society. Look to Japan. What the occupiers did in Japan? Yeah, if we go back in 1945, our Hague regulations of 1907 were long in place. So if you don't want to suggest that the examples of Germany and Japan were examples of illegality by the occupying powers, then the occupier probably has much wider powers than is normally perceived. And again, you can take this reality check further. If you look at neutral countries like Sweden or Switzerland, neutral countries in the Second World War, so they were not bound by any kind of allegiance to the Allies, to the United Nations during the war, but still they accepted the legislative measures taken by the Allies in Germany and Japan. So they didn't question the lawmaking power. If you look again at another example, the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. Here my colleagues normally claim that this is an example where the international community has condemned the lawmaking activities of the occupant. But I beg to disagree. There is a lot of condemnation of Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, and there is some outright condemnation of Israeli lawmaking for the Palestinian territories, but these, or for the Arab territories, but these resolutions concern first the Syrian Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, and there are these two territories that Israel has formally annexed. So the condemnation and the lawmaking refers or relates more to the annexation of these territories by Israel and Israel imposing its laws in this territory than that it deals with general occupation. So the normal legislative measures in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank haven't seen the same explicit condemnation as, for example, the Golan Heights. And my last example is northern Cyprus. Occupied since 1983 by Turkish troops, again, society has been remodeled in Turkey's image, you could say. The laws have been changed from former British colonial laws that were in place in the 1960s when Cyprus became independent to kind of Turkish laws, especially in the legal system. The laws are now resembling the Turkish legal situation to a large extent. So I conclude that the occupier has much wider legislative powers that are normally perceived. That doesn't say that all the legislation enacted by the coalition provisional authority in Iraq is lawful, but I would put forward that much more is lawful than is normally perceived to be lawful in the academic debate. So I'd say that probably, and that's what I'm doing in the book that's forthcoming, I'm scrutinizing every legislative act with regard to this yardstick of necessity and of rebuilding societies. And there are some laws that are clearly outside this, and there are a lot of laws you could actually justify under this new theory. Thank you.
Those of us who teach legislation for a living, looking at historical circumstances and replowing text is rich ground. But Dale, John, and others who will nod or wink. Oh, you want rebuttal? Okay, go ahead.
No, I think that the analysis of the Article 43 of the Hague Regulations is very appropriate here, and I think it's unfortunate that this provision is typically given in the English version, which is highly inaccurate. I mean, it's one of the, when I teach international law and teach students about treaties that are, well, you have sometimes treaties drafted in more than one language. Mm. Sometimes you just have treaties drafted in one language and then translated in another language. But in any event, you need to pay attention to which is the real text. And here, this English text is a phony text. It's not done by a charlatan. It was done by the U.S. Congress at the time that this was being proposed to the Senate for ratification. But the only official text of the treaty was in French. And it doesn't really make sense in English with public order and safety, which makes it sound as if the occupier can do things to protect itself. Mm. I mean, it makes it sound as if it's giving the occupier power to do things against the population, whereas in fact it's the reverse. The l'ordre et la vie publique, as Professor Talman quoted it, means that the occupier has to protect or preserve life as it is to the extent feasible. There's this escape clause, but in general has to preserve life to the extent feasible unless prevented. And that language, unless prevented, makes more sense if you follow the French rather than the English. But I think that does set a very high standard for an occupant. But I think it is appropriate to look at some of the situations Professor Talman mentions where the necessity may allow a broader role. I mean, if you do have a state that fails, then institutions that dissipate, then that does perhaps give the occupier greater powers. I think that this was all written on the premise that the occupier would come in and that there would still be institutions available from the state that has sovereignty, and that those should be allowed to operate. You should allow the courts to operate, for example. But if that doesn't happen, I mean, if all the judges flee the country, then the occupier is in a situation of having to provide some kind of system and may have some broader powers. With regard to the United States and viewing human rights law as being preempted by the law of belligerent occupation, I think it's right that it generally has done so. There's one instance, the situation of torture, where I think Condoleezza Rice has made statements about the torture convention, suggesting that she recognizes the torture convention as being applicable to the United States. I mean, this has been in the context where the United States was pressed on the torture issue and pressed for violating the torture convention. I have a recollection.
Yeah, that's true. But of course, the problem here is that the United States interprets torture under the torture convention different from everybody else.
Well, that's
so you can accept it in the U.S. interpretation of torture, but if you look at it in the interpretation of the rest of the world, then you could say it's still not accepted, really.
Right. So, yes.
Because you made a reservation when signing the torture convention, basically limiting torture to acts of severe physical suffering, whereas the internationally accepted definition of torture is much wider and is not restricted to physical suffering. It's also mental suffering, and it doesn't have to be severe. So it's probably the acceptance by Condoleezza Rice is the American acceptance of the torture definition.
Maybe, it doesn't go against the United States as strongly as it might, but I mean, she is, I think, recognizing the proposition of the applicability. But with respect to human rights, I mean, I think, as you say, that sometimes that also does give the occupier more latitude. I mean, that was one of the counter arguments you mentioned. I mean, if, for example, you have an occupier who comes in, and let's say it's more than just a two-week occupation, it's a longer-term occupation. Suppose the laws in the country on elections don't allow women to vote. Would the occupier be required to conduct elections in which women don't vote? I think on situations like that, it's probably regarded as within the powers of the occupier to make changes consistent with human rights. But I think, as you pointed out, it would be difficult to take that and expand it to a restructuring of the economy of the country, that you can't read that so broadly.
John, I'm going to...
Okay, I'll stop.
I'll come back to you, but I want to make sure that I roll some other people in. Dale.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I was pleasantly surprised by your talk.
Can you elaborate on this?
I'll elaborate for you later.
You gave sort of an almost German approach to the technical side of the language, trying to hear it with a startling defense of the fact that our occupation is not illegal, which was a pleasant surprise. I
All right.
assume somebody from Oxford would be over here railing about how illegal it was. Now, which causes me to bring up the next question, which is, in this kind of a debate, do you find that your colleagues in the international law area are heavily influenced by where they want to go in these kinds of debates? If I'm upset with what the United States is doing, is that going to affect how I make these arguments and how I'm comfortable with your arguments? Do you find that when you're presenting your paper
The general perception of the United States at the moment, and probably the public relations work your president does, influences the academic debate in Europe to a large extent. And of course, with regard to occupation and the view people take on occupation, this is also, of course, heavily influenced by the view they take on the war. So if the war was illegal, so the occupation must be illegal. So the one follows from the other. So and as you have almost universal condemnation in Europe of the war as such. It would be difficult to stand up and say, oh, the war was illegal, but actually not all the legislative measures by the occupant are illegal. This is too much differentiated. You know, this doesn't fit into the overall scheme.
Maybe this follows on a little bit, actually, because that question of, you know, the relationship between the original thing that got you to be the occupier and the occupation. Mm-hmm. My question was really about your test, the necessity test, and the context is relevant. I'm not sure if you used the word context, I forgot, but... Mm-hmm. Because there seems a danger there that the greater the outside force, in this case the US, mm-hmm. is arguably infringing sovereignty, the greater the authority they have to change the laws. If context is relevant, then if your sort of goal is relevant, mm-hmm. then if your goal is to completely change mm-hmm. and restructure a country and sort of reform it in your own image, then the danger of a necessity sort of context dependent test would mean that, oh, you were allowed to do that, but if your goal was just to keep order, then mm. that's all you could do.
Yes. But I think you're right. If you go for regime change, you have to bring down the regime first. Then you have to completely destroy it so that they basically disperse and there is nobody left. And then you can start rebuilding, you know. And to be honest, I think if we look at international law and if we look at international politics these days, since international law has outlawed the annexation of foreign territory, I think annexation has been replaced by what could be called reformative occupation. If you cannot basically incorporate a foreign territory, you have to model it in your own image. You want to have at least an ally after the occupation, perhaps even more. So if you go through all the trouble these days to actually have a full-blown war, as we have seen in Iraq, with all the costs involved, then and you have a sustained occupation over like 14 months, then you're probably aiming for changing that society in your image. Because otherwise, probably it's not worth going for it. If you just go in for 2 weeks, and that was probably the reason why in 1991, at the time, one didn't march on Baghdad. Because at that time, the time wasn't probably right, basically, to bring down the whole regime. That was a classical conflict where Iraq had invaded Kuwait. You basically drive them out of Kuwait, you might occupy Baghdad, you have a kind of settlement, but Saddam Hussein might still be in place. It is like Germany moving into Paris in 1871, 2 weeks or 4 weeks staying there, and moving out again. So you have achieved your aims, your military aims, you have got the contract, the treaty you wanted, and that's the end of it. So, yeah, I agree with you. You have to bring down the regime to change things and make it really happen.
Well, I guess then the follow-up is your test a kind of a more objective test or subjective? I mean, do you measure it, the necessity, by the standard of the occupier mm-hmm. or some external?
Yeah, that's something I'm still not clear about. My provisional thinking is that there is a presumption for the occupier, so that there is a large discretion on the part of the occupier to determine what is absolutely necessary. But of course, this is a general problem with international law. Who determines in the end? Of course, we have these tests of necessity in national law where the courts will always decide, was it really necessary? So if one of these legislative measures would in some miraculous way end up before the International Court of Justice, then the International Court of Justice would have to apply a test of necessity. So I think there is a presumption on the part of the occupier, but it's refutable.
I have Alan, Greg, Ruth, and Saul.
This is, I guess, getting at the same thing that the other questions are, but maybe in a different way. I'm looking at the word laws in the Hague Regulation of 1907, and assuming that wasn't mistranslated from French. It seems to me that part of the issue is what is a law? I mean, we have this idea of law of being regularized and not arbitrary. So if you go into a country, that the law is also the will of the dictator, and we have courts that enforce that person's will, whatever it is. There's no whatever common notions of trial or whatever. That person wants executed and executed. Or even take Saudi Arabia, where their law is, as I understand it, there's no rights to any religious practice that doesn't conform to their religious practice. And people who don't adhere to it don't have any rights. I don't think of that as a law. That's just too arbitrary. I think that came out, that was part of what was involved in World War II. People said you were following laws, and the Nuremberg trial said, well, no, there's a law, that's not a valid defense. And so don't you have, in making this kind of determination, doesn't there have to be some thought about what, just because there's been a rule followed, that doesn't make it law, according to the Western idea of that.
But of course, we don't apply the Western ideal in international law. So it's up to each state how it wants to organize itself internally. So that's the shield of sovereignty that shields your internal affairs from the concerns of other states or from international law. That shield becomes more and more like a Swiss cheese now with lots of holes where human rights and other standards move into, but it's still a functioning shield. So I don't think that we can basically superimpose our ideas of what a law should be, because then probably we can rule out probably 80 or 90 states in the United Nations and ask whether they have proper laws in place, because they are not democratically made in the way we perceive laws to be made in this country or in Europe.
Democratic, I meant some sort of regularized, non-arbitrary administration. I mean, let me ask it this way. What is your definition of a law? Is a law anything that is enforced, no matter how arbitrary we may see it, or how, that people who practice another, practice Christianity are executed? Is that a law that an occupier, it's enforced, occupying force comes in, are they obligated, absent some overriding requirement, to follow that as a law?
Again, we have to look back what was originally intended. The idea was you move in with your army, probably the king still being present, locked up in a castle for a time until he signs the treaty, but the administration still in place. The occupier would not establish a second administration. So the ordinary laws would still be applied by the administrative authorities of the occupied state. And they would continue to apply their laws, because it says the laws in force in the country. So that's the laws in force at the time you move into that country, the time you occupy it. And you have to take the legal situation as it is at that time. And I would take any command as a law in that respect. And even if you think about the arbitrary and obnoxious laws of the Nuremberg race laws in Germany, for example, they were all done wonderfully in the formalistic way of German lawmaking. So what do you want more of a law? It's published in the Gazette. It even went through parliamentary procedures. So it's just the content of the law you don't agree with. So you have to take the laws as they stand. But of course, as I said before, human rights concerns, as John already mentioned, come in here. So if you have a law in place that, for example, discriminates on the basis of race, religion, or sex, for example, and you are under an obligation not to discriminate on these bases, then you better change that law, because otherwise you will be held liable, you will be responsible, because the acts of the local administration which applies that law will be attributed to you during the time of occupation, because you would have the chance to change these laws. So, yeah, I think you have to take the law as it stands and cannot superimpose our views or some view of law on that.
Greg?
Just two real quick things. I mean, it seems to me that it's actually two points. One is that it seems to be very difficult, particularly in a context like Iraq, to sort of separate what you've described as economic measures and security measures. And, I mean, it's hard to put them in a box. And it does seem to me that the connection, particularly in Iraq, between the economic viability of the country, in both the short term and the long term, has been demonstrated, I think, to be critical to the security situation. One of the complaints is that we, in fact, didn't transform the economy enough, and that's why the security situation is as bad as it is. And had the electricity worked better, and had there been an increased climate for both foreign and domestic investment and a whole variety of economic measures that would provide jobs, would provide a sense of sort of a future, that the security situation. So it does seem to me to say that, well, the economic measures that transform the society sort of outside the box allowed by the Hague regulations and security, and the Geneva Convention, is a little bit artificial, or at least there's a danger of sort of artificial categorization. Secondly, my sense is, and this is just purely an historical question, I mean, we all, I think, have a sense of what the cultural and political transformations, and I'm thinking particularly of Japan as a result of World War II occupation. My sense is, although I really don't have any historical knowledge to back this up, specific historical knowledge, is that the economic institutions in Japan after World War II were also substantially transformed. Now, I may be wrong there, but if I'm not wrong, then that also, it seems to me, provides some additional historical basis for your conclusion that the record, in fact, supports the broader reading that you're suggesting.
He's correct. Corporate code in Japan,
yeah.
Corporate code in Germany.
Yeah.
They were very different.
Yeah, because the...
Correct.
Can I just answer your first point? I think I don't categorize or put things in a box. I see that security depends on the economic situation. I would say that both, or more than these two elements, actually feed into my assessment of necessity. It's all part whether something is necessary. A new... company code or a new law on foreign investment may be necessary because it creates outside investment, which will then thereby alter the situation on the ground, will improve the economic situation on the of the people in the occupied territory, thereby improve the security situation. It's not one-dimensional. It all feeds into the overall assessment of necessity. So I don't look at one measure as such and say, okay, do we need a board of supreme audit, for example? Because then I would say, no, we don't need a board of supreme audit because you can run an economy without such a board. But that you run an economy well and that it functions well, especially if you have a history of corruption in a country, which is basically inherent in the system, there you might need such a board to kick-start the economy at the time when you actually move in. Because if you just leave everything in place and then you hand out food vouchers to people, you could say that's also perfectly possible. You can occupy the country as it was, you just bring in food aid, everybody is happy, and after the time you move out again. Probably you would actually have had more security if you just had all these handouts to people. But that was not sustainable in the long run. So you basically went for the kind of more market approach. But I think you all have to see it in this kind of necessity test.
I have a question about how much running room you might get out of some large obligations. And the questions and answers when you've given examples about the human rights obligations, in the United States before we had our Bill of Rights, in Canada before they had their own Bill of Rights, and in England for time immemorial, the thought was, well, you don't need to have human rights codes because you can use structural protections to protect minority groups. That was the argument for why we needed Bill of Rights in our original constitution. Of course, that view was agreed fairly quickly, but Canada took that view for a much longer period of time. And so could one then argue by extension that actually to protect human rights you have to do more than ban race and sex discrimination, that you also have to have certain fundamental rules of the way society is governed, that could this actually sort of, or was a little bit on your argument, you know, well, you need economic reform to have human rights, you need security to have human rights. So I'm just wondering if anyone has sort of tried to run with the human rights obligation in that way, or it's always just pure human rights, only if it says race and gender.
No. Human rights is understood in a wider context, but still some of the institutional reforms that have been undertaken, you just can't relate to human rights. Of course, I could say you need a functioning court system, for example, to enforce your human rights. You need certain procedures in place. But of course, with regard to other measures, it's very difficult to establish a link between human rights and what has been done on the ground. So not everything feeds into human rights.
I mean, could you say having a market? That's what I'm saying. Can you make economic marketplace arguments and say some of that feeds into human rights?
It's probably very difficult, because then you could relate everything to human rights.
Right.
So the question is, where do you draw the line? But again, that's the nice thing about international law. That has to work itself out in state practice. So I think the Iraqi example is very good, because it's one example of state practice we can work on within future, and we can now do more research and test, for example, the reaction of other states with regard to individual measures to see how customary international law in that area develops. I think it's just too early to tell, and basically my contribution is one first step, and others will follow up on that.
So. Actually, that was going to be my main question, which is this sort of a sea change in the way we look at occupation? Because in some ways, I mean, when you look at the regime change concept in the past, whether it's the U.S. and Japan or Germany, that while we changed some things economically, there are certainly wholesale structures that were kept. But who gets to make the call when the real regime change happens, where you have the broader latitude that at least the U.S. is showing in Iraq that, you know, we need to sweep this stuff aside. And this is, again, I mean, it's the greater quandary and concept of international laws. Who's the enforcer? Who gets the say? Which is why I'm saying, you know, is this sort of a change? Is Iraq going to be observed as a model for going forward?
I can't tell. I'm sure it will be an important precedent for any future occupations. It was very interesting to see when the occupation started, and the people here in the administration and back home in the UK thought about what to do. They looked back at the manual that was drafted in 1941 for the future occupation of Germany and Japan. So that was the reference point then. So I assume that the reference point for any future occupation will be Iraq. And we'll just have to see how it plays out. And I'm sure we won't, at least that's my view, I don't think that we will see a traditional occupation which we had in the early 20th century. Armies marching in, occupying something for a certain time, you come to a peace treaty, everything retreats, and that's the end of the matter. You will undertake any kind of, you will undertake occupation only with a purpose. And the purpose probably is regime change. If you think about the next regime change, might be Iran, might be North Korea. We won't see that the system there will be kept in place. It will just be removed. And having said that, it actually fits nicely into the German and Japanese line of precedent, because in Iraq, although I've just concentrated on the changes, probably 80% of the laws have remained in place. So we just see the tip of the iceberg that really has been changed.
Let me interject a quick
question before I move to the next person who had their hand up. People have been pressing you, Stefan, on how far to extend this notion of what the meaning of public life is, what the meaning of necessity is, what the meaning of orderly government might be. And you said it in your talk that you did have in mind some limits. I mean, it seems to me, given where you're taking this turn in international law, that's a question people are going to ask you. I mean, okay, so you've now expanded that, I mean, using historical models, you've expanded and contested with the majority of your colleagues how broadly to do this. Do you have limits? Do you have examples of either aspects of the law or types of laws that wouldn't fit into the Hague and Geneva definitions?
Yeah. The limits are on page 6 of my speaking notes. I just skipped them because I thought I was running out of time. So the limits we have are, of course, the Geneva Conventions itself, which actually impose certain limits. It's like, if you think about, and we'll talk about this next week with regard to Security Council legislation, the UN Charter is the framework in which this happens. So occupation still happens within the framework of the Geneva Convention, because according to my interpretation, the Geneva Convention actually provides or allows legislation by the occupant. But it also contains constraints on this legislation. Then, of course, we have international human rights law, which will also act as a constraining element. So you cannot just, for example, enact a law that would, for example, change the law of succession. That was interesting in the Iraqi example, because the Iraqi Governing Council once wanted actually to change the law and wanted to introduce Sharia law again for succession, and wanted to replace the ordinary civil law that was in place. And that was one of the laws actually Bremer didn't sign, and said that we can't do that, even if that would be a true expression of self-determination of the Iraqi Governing Council, and for one time they really had something to decide and not just sign something the CPA basically put in front of them. That was a law he didn't sign because he said that would be contrary to all human rights obligations the United States is under. Then, of course, we have obligations of general international law, so procedural obligations the occupier is under, international criminal law standards the occupier is under. The outer limit, I'd say, and I'm still not sure how exactly to define that, is the right of self-determination in international law, because some of my colleagues have argued that this has achieved the status of jus cogens. So even if we have a authority to legislate in the Geneva Convention, so if I construe that there is a authority to legislate, this would still be subject to the norm of jus cogens. And how to define these outer limits, areas where the occupant just can't legislate because it's so inherent in self-determination that the people themselves have to do it, that will have to be figured out over time. Whereas, on the other hand, one must always bear in mind that all occupation law is, at least in theory, temporary law. As soon as the occupation comes to an end, the new government or the old returning government of the occupied state is free to change all occupation law and to replace it with its own laws. Of course, in practice, that might be different because you will just have a fait accompli, and certain measures, especially if you have a prolonged belligerent occupation, will just be so ingrained that the new or the returning sovereign will not be able to alter it anymore. So once actually the new economic system has taken roots, it will be different to return to a command economy or so.
I also have a question about limits. As I understand it, we've been talking about limits on the scope of change, the types of law that could be revised. I'm wondering if there's any source of international law or anyplace else of limiting the types of changes that get made. So, for example, from what I've read, Bremer had a particular notion of the way an economy ought to work, and that was incorporated into the changes that were made. Are there limits on the sub? And from what you said, I would assume that human rights would impose one limit on the types of changes that could be made. But beyond the scope, are there limits on the content?
Apart from the ones you would probably construe from the various human rights obligations, it would be very difficult to say that there are limits. Of course, we have, of course, the traditional limit in international law, which says that every country is free to choose its own economic and political system. But, of course, we have left this limit long behind us when we actually enter this area of legislation via the occupant. Because otherwise no change is possible if we stick to this principle. And if we leave this principle behind, then it's basically up to the occupant. Again, the occupant has a certain discretion what laws to adopt. I assume that the Soviet occupant in 1980 moving into Afghanistan, if they had established a full-blown occupation, they probably would have had a different view of how they would like to remodel a society. Or if perhaps China would move into Taiwan, they will have a different view of the US how to remodel China, Taiwan in their image, if they occupied as a separate territory and not basically incorporated it. So it will always depend on the occupant. Again, international law has no rules how a perfect society should look like, so that we can actually take that as a yardstick. This is left to each society, how it wants to organize itself. And in that case, it's probably left to the occupier, you know, how it wants to organize the society it occupies.
I know there are a couple of other people who have questions, and I want them to be able to ask Stefan, but I also know that people have been trickling out because they have classes, and so what I'd like to do is bring this to a formal close and thank Stefan for what he's presented and also his provocative answers to questions, and then invite people to come up and ask him as many questions as he can stomach, consistent with stomaching the rest of his lunch. Thank you very much.